Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with Denise Merrill. She's the Secretary of State for the great state of Connecticut, one of seven states with unified Democratic control. You know, states are important. What's going on in the states is really, really important. And that's what we'll be talking about with our next guest, Lala Wu. She's a co-founder of the Sister District Project. It's another one of these resistance groups that kind of popped up after the 2016 election. It is something that it's part of something bigger that I hope creates an enduring piece of progressive infrastructure. And then finally, and with apologies, we'll be joined by Carolee Coons, the managing editor of Crooks and Liars, to talk about this moronic QAnon conspiracy theory. And I'm sorry about that. I tried to avoid it, but it's a real thing, and it's a real thing for a very large number of Trump supporters, or a growing number of Trump supporters, I guess. I don't know that we know the numbers exactly, but it seems fairly big in Trump, in moronic Trump circles. Anyway, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
Sad America.
Welcome back. You know, there's more than just control of the House at stake in this year's midterm elections. And, you know, I've been looking at glimmers of hope in these dark times. And one is that it appears that Democrats appear to be contesting state legislative and judicial races seriously. And they've been neglecting these for a long time. Right now, Republicans enjoy unified control of 26 state governments, while Democrats enjoy a so-called trifecta, which is where one party controls the governor's office and both chambers of the legislature. In seven or eight states, depending on whether you count New York, we have this senator named Simca Felder, who was elected as a Democrat, but he caucuses with Republicans. Anyway, this fall, Dems could form a couple of new trifectas in Colorado, Illinois, maybe New York, and could also break a few GOP trifectas. So these next two elections will be super important because, of course, after the 2020 census, they'll do that decennial redistricting, and if Republicans control all these state houses, we're going to be in really trouble. Anyway, I'm very pleased to welcome Denise Merrill to the show. Denise is Connecticut's Secretary of State. She has she served as a Secretary of State since 2011, and before that, she was the House Majority Leader in the State Assembly. Denise Miller, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you very much.
Speaking of glimmers of hope, and I think that it's important to remain hopeful when one can. You recently told NPR that there is some encouraging news in terms of voter registrations in Connecticut.
Yes, there is indeed. And I think there's a number of reasons for it. But the big one is everyone seems to have woken up to politics. We have 275,000 new registered voters in Connecticut, which, to put it in context, is that we have 2 million, roughly, give or take. And normally in a period, this is since the 2016 election, normally in the 2 years following an election, a midterm like that, or a presidential, you'd get maybe half that, if that. So we have doubled the number of new voters that we're traditionally getting. It's amazing.
And you noticed that a lot of these were younger voters, right?
Yeah, that's the other thing. 18 to 24-year-olds, we typically would get maybe 25,000 new younger voters. We got more like 45,000, almost double. Yep, it's a big deal.
I mean, there does seem to be an awful amount of enthusiasm on the Democratic side, and I think, again, in my list of like glimmers of hope, that's one of them. There are backlash politics, and then perhaps we're seeing a backlash against the backlash, right? I mean, that seems to be one of the kind of themes that has been evident in all these special election swings and you just see it also in the streets. Now, speaking of voter registrations, in June, the Supreme Court upheld Ohio's controversial system for purging voters from the rolls. And then last month, the Brennan Center for Justice issued this report, and they found that red states, which are no longer subject to getting the federal government to pre-clear changes in their election systems as a result of that same court invalidating parts of the Voting Rights Act, they've been especially aggressive. So, and they found that all in all, in all states between 2014 and 2016, states removed almost 16 million voters from the rolls. And according to the report, and I quote, when done correctly, this is a key word, purges ensure the voter rolls are accurate and up to date. When done incorrectly, purges disenfranchise legitimate voters. If there is, if a lot, I think a lot of people have come to the point where they think purging is inherently evil, or it is inherently a tactic designed to suppress the vote. Can you talk about the difference between doing this correctly and incorrectly?
Absolutely. And, you know, I have to say, all of us want our lists to be as accurate as possible. That's the goal. That's good for everyone. And there's different ways to do that that are both good and bad. But it turns out it's extraordinarily tricky to try to match data, particularly across states. And that's what some of these systems are designed to try to figure out. How many people are registered more than once, particularly if they're registered more than once in more than one state? Now, needless to say, many of us might be registered in more than one place because we moved and didn't take our name off one roll and put it on another. But what some of these states have done is they've used a system that just has enormous numbers of false positives. It turns out to be very hard to match the same Jose Rodriguez, just to take an example, I think that's
right.
pretty much going on,
yeah.
With a Jose Rodriguez in another state, because you have to use at least three data points to make sure it's really true. And the states that have gone this direction and are really seemingly intent on purging people from the list more than normal are places like Florida, where they used a cross-check system, which was developed by a guy named Chris Kobach, who has since become pretty notorious for his kind of attempts to kind of stop people from voting, honestly. It's a system where they try to do this cross-check without a really sufficient data match, and it has notoriously produced very bad, bad matching. So bad in Florida when they used it, the governor had to apologize to the thousands of people who were thrown off the voters' rolls incorrectly because it wasn't the same Jose Rodriguez, amazingly. So, but there are systems to do this that do work. And some states are a member of a consortium called ERIC, which was developed by the Pew Foundation, which really is a match because it's not like it's bad to clean up your list. We need accurate lists. And there are millions of people who are probably registered in more than one place. But that's not against the law. What's against the law is voting twice.
Right.
I think there's an estimate somewhere that I saw from Pew, I think, that something like 12 million people are probably registered in more than one place. That doesn't mean that it's on purpose. You have to have an intent to defraud somehow. So they've used this, they've jumped into this kind of complicated breach to take a lot of people off the voter rolls. So for example, in Indiana, my colleague there used a similar system to the cross-check and threw off 500,000 people in one fell swoop. And that was about 6 months ago. And the other thing I should say, it's not just about when you create a match of some sort that enables you to take someone off a list. There are lots of federal laws about when and how you do that. You should never just take someone off a list based on a match like that without first allowing them to go on to what we call an inactive list and to keep their name on the list in case they do show up to vote. And the federal law, which I think is a good law, is that you must have not voted in at least two federal elections before you're permanently removed from a roll. So that's the other piece of this that I think is important to know.
So in Ohio, so how do they actually do it? There's a letter sent. For those of us who don't pay close attention to this, beyond the cross-check issue, the state sends out a letter and says, are you still living at this address? And then if you don't write back, they tell us a little bit about the details of how this works.
Yeah, I mean, you can use various methods to do this, but basically under federal law, you are required to send a letter every year to every voter and ask if they still live at that address. If the voter doesn't send it back, you have to wait until they both don't send the letter back and don't vote for two
right.
federal elections. Then you can permanently remove them from a list. If they simply don't send back the letter, you are able, after one election where they don't vote, to put them on what we call the inactive voter list. It's a special list where they're still sort of there. They're kind of in purgatory. And if they show up to vote and say, oh, I'm supposed to be on this list, then you just simply reinstate them. So that's
they don't need a provisional ballot if they're on the inactive list?
No.
And what is Ohio doing specifically?
Well, they were simply taking people off the rolls simply if they didn't vote, which is specifically against what we thought was the federal law, although the Supreme Court doesn't seem to agree anymore. Basically, you cannot remove someone simply because they didn't vote, which is what we thought the law was. And that's what they were doing in Ohio. They were just taking people off the rolls who simply hadn't voted in one election, as I understand it. So,
go ahead. Sorry.
And then they judged that to be sufficient to take them off the rolls. So they were taking thousands of people off the rolls simply because they didn't come vote. Now, it's your right not to vote as much as it's your right to vote. So that's sure. why the federal law always said you can't take someone off the rolls just because they didn't show up for a couple of elections. So
I'm sure I've been purged from a lot of voter rolls just because I've moved around the country quite a bit, and I always vote, and I've never deregistered, right? I've never actually
right.
gone down and said, oh, I'm moving, so take my name off the roll. So
right.
I'm sure that this process has been done legitimately with my name in various places where I've been registered previously and then no longer am. So we had some researchers from the University of San Diego on. They did a study about strict voter ID laws. Pardon me. They said that their findings were that these laws, which are ostensibly neutral, they decrease Democratic turnout by 8.8 percentage points and Republican turnout by 3.6 percentage points. So the spread is 5.2 percentage points. Do we know something similar about voting purges? Do we know how they impact different demographics, for example?
Well, this is pretty recent. So actually, I think the first wave of what I would describe as voter suppression was probably the voter ID laws.
Right.
And again, just like this idea of keeping clean lists, it was very insidious in the sense that you thought, well, it sounds kind of reasonable. Why shouldn't you have to have an ID to vote, right? But then the devil's in the details. So every state was a little different, but there were only certain kinds of IDs you could use, and that differed by state. So the most notorious was, of course, the Texas situation where that you could use your, they said you had to have a picture on it. And frankly, there's no really good data reason to have a picture. But
right.
that was the insistence on in most of these states. And then you could only use certain things that had pictures. So in Texas, you could use your gun license, which had a picture, but you could not use your student ID, which also had a picture.
Yeah.
And that seemed fairly pointed because that obviously, you know, you can see that it would impact different constituencies, you know, gun owners mostly probably being Republican, students, many of whom are Democrats. So I don't know. This newest wave of laws, you know, purportedly protecting the list, it's the same thing. It sounds kind of reasonable. You say, well, yeah, shouldn't we have an accurate list? Of course we should. It's just when you do it and how you do it that's the problem. And I would suspect that it would impact Democrats more if you assume that most of those people are going to be younger, probably, maybe move more. We were just discussing that.
Right.
You know, maybe the people who are not frequent voters.
Right.
Because as I understood it, in general, I have to say Republicans are probably more reliable voters than many Democrats. And that's been shown over and over. I have not seen any studies that talk directly about what the impact is, but you can imagine that it would be similar.
Yeah, it would be disparate. And one thing that I think really stands out just intuitively is that midterm dropout among demographics that tend to vote for Democrats, so that there's a fairly large group of people who skip a federal election every 2 years.
That's know? Right. Yep, that's right.
It's pernicious. It's, you know, a party that doesn't feel secure in terms of persuading people with the benefits of their policy proposals and is doing what it can to limit the franchise to their own people. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Denise Merrill. She's the Secretary of State for the great state of Connecticut. Let me switch tacks a little bit. So DNI Dan Coats and others have been warning that Russia is trying to reprise its attack on the 2016 elections. It does not appear that the Trump regime is taking that threat very seriously. Congressional Republicans have rebuffed efforts by Democrats to increase funding for election security. And two Democratic candidates so far, Claire McCaskill of Missouri and Jeanne Shaheen from New Hampshire, say that there have been recent attempts to hack their campaign. So let me ask you, what are you doing to secure Connecticut's vote? And can you also speak to what your colleagues in some other states are doing?
Yes, we became aware of this really after the fact in about a year ago. there was testimony before a congressional hearing by the Department of Homeland Security that 21 states there had been attempts to get into their voter list, the voter registry. Every state has an online voter registry, which, by the way, is usually the only part of our election system that is online. So we immediately were surprised because we had not heard about it. No one had told anyone in our states about this. So that led to a long year of discussion and debate about all this. But it turns out, you know, of course, the first thing we wanted to know is my state one of them? And we couldn't be told because it was all secure information. And so it took a while for us to get to the bottom of it. But it is true. Connecticut was one of those 21 states where there were IP addresses from Russian agencies that were identified as trying to enter our system. Now, the good news is, most of the 20 of the 21 states, they didn't get in. So although I guess I'd describe these as attempted hacks, I'm not even sure of that, because the lingo in this whole thing is very important, because when you say Russia hacked our election, it sounds like they got in. That's actually not true in most cases, except in Illinois, apparently. And we just found this out recently that they actually did get into the Illinois system. But as far as we know, nothing happened. So we really think, after going to a lot of classified briefings, because I now have security clearance because I need to know when these things happen, going to these briefings, I think the distinct impression we have is that the campaign of disinformation, as we're now calling it, is a much more important and big problem than the actual technical hacking of anything in the election system. I think I can safely say that based on everything we've done since then, the communication system we've set up with DHS and others are really mean. I think that the 2018 election is probably even more secure than the 2016 was. And I don't think it's such a problem. I think the big problem is all the false Facebook sites, the information that's going out to people. That is all very real. And I think the biggest problem is it's creating this immense amount of distrust in the elections, which is fatal to democracy. If you start having a situation where no one thinks that the election results are real, then we really do have a problem. I think that is much more of a worry than the hacking.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think one of the most frustrating parts of it is that it's very clear that the Russian disinformation campaign has been consistently designed to build on and aggravate existing social tensions. So, we found out through the release of some of these ads that, you know, they take both sides of the national anthem flap, or they'd pose as Black Lives Matter and neo-Confederates, and kind of ramp up these hostilities that we already have towards each other, these enmities that divide us as a people. It's really, really pernicious. Anyway, I believe we're out of time. Denise Merrill, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
Once upon a time, at the foot of a great mountain, there was a town where the people known as Happy Folk lived. Their very existence a mystery to the rest of the world, obscured as it was by great clouds. Here they played out their peaceful lives, innocent of the litany of excess and violence that was growing in the world below. To live in harmony with the spirit of the mountain called Monkey was enough. Then one day, strange folk arrived in the town. They came in camouflage, hidden behind dark glasses, but no one noticed them. They only saw shadows. You see, without the truth to the eyes, the happy folk were blind.
Falling out of aeroplanes and hiding out in holes, waiting for the sunset to come, people going home. Jump out from behind them and shoot them in the head. Now everybody dancing, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
In time, the strange folk found their way into the higher reaches of the mountain, and it was there that they found the caves of unimaginable sincerity and beauty. By chance, they stumbled upon the place where all good souls come to rest. The strange folk, they coveted the jewels in these caves above all things, and soon they began to mine the mountain, its rich scene fueling the chaos of their own world. Meanwhile, down in the town, the happy folk slept restlessly, their dreams invaded by shadowy figures digging away at their souls. Every day, people would wake and stare at the mountain. Why was it bringing darkness into their lives? And as the strange folk mined deeper and deeper into the mountain, holes began to appear, bringing with them a cold and bitter wind that chilled the very soul of the monkey. For the first time, the happy folk felt fearful, for they knew that soon the monkey would stir from its deep sleep. Then there came a sound, distant first, that grew into gastrophony so immense that it could be heard far away in space. There were no screams. There was no time. The mountain called Monkey had spoken. There was only fire. And then nothing.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. And I mean it. I'm going to write a piece at some point soon about glimmers of hope, little things to be hopeful about, because we can't just be demoralized. It doesn't work, right? There's strength in numbers. We're not powerless here. And remember, Trump is, you know, he is a minority president. He was elected with a minority of the vote. And he is supported by a relatively small group of tenacious knuckleheads. Anyway, in keeping with that, I was in Netroots Nation in Las Vegas 2 weeks ago now. And as I mentioned last week, and I met this young woman, and I thought, wow, this is the other thing that I'm kind of hopeful for, that there's this backlash against the backlash. People are getting involved who, you know, weren't necessarily political junkies, and they're saying, hey, we need to fight for pluralism. We need to fight for our democratic tradition here, our small d democratic tradition. And my next guest kind of epitomizes that, and also she's got a lot of energy. Lala Wu has what is your title, Lala?
I am one of the co-founders of the Sister District Project, and I'm also the Director of Engagement and Partnerships.
Okay, so Lala Wu is the Director of Engagement and Partnerships and a co-founder of the Sister District Project. Lala Wu, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks so much, Joshua. Glad to be here.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. Tell me, so there's this kind of almost stereotype at this point of the resistance leader. As someone who wasn't necessarily focused on politics on a daily basis and was kind of shocked into action by the election of Trump, and that kind of fits you, right?
Yes, it absolutely does. Before this, my previous political experience had been limited to knocking on quite a few doors, but for presidential campaigns, you know, for Kerry and for Obama, Hillary, but I had not made politics the center of my life. And on that fateful evening in 2016, you know, a lot of us felt a lot of things. And one of them for me was a call to action, like for many others.
And what, tell us a little bit about the Sister District Project. How do you guys function? What is your role in this? And you identified something that was kind of missing in the existing democratic/progressive infrastructure?
Yes, absolutely. So in your introduction, you mentioned that President Trump is a minority president, and that's exactly right. Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by almost 3 million votes, yet she did not win the presidency, because the way that our country is designed, the way the electoral politics is designed, it's such that this can happen. Our power as Democrats and as progressives is oftentimes concentrated in these big blue metropolitan areas. And so the gap that we're trying to fill at the Sister District Project is trying to figure out how we can make this feel a little bit more balanced, how we can load balance our resources across the country so that everybody's voices are heard.
Now, go ahead.
So the one thing that we really focused on early on is we realized the importance of state legislative elections. And I know that you've had your colleague Joan Walsh on this show before talking about the importance of state legislative elections. But we at Sister District are, as part of what we do, training a cadre of state ledge evangelists. I am one myself. And the reason for this is that in 37 states, states control redistricting. So if you want to do anything about gerrymandering, you have to go to the state level. And then also these are the places where we're developing the progressive policies that we all care about. And this is how we can create the policies that really impact people's lives. And then finally, for the progressive pipeline, if we are to introduce a bring up new leaders who are going to be strong national leaders, they have to start somewhere. And almost half of all of our presidents so far have been state legislators in the past. So for these three reasons, redistricting, progressive policy, progressive leaders pipeline, we focused on state legislatures. And the thing that we've hit on that I think is really unique at Sister District is that we find the capacity and use it wherever it is. And so in this case, we have this strong capacity in San Francisco Bay Area, where I live, in New York City, you know, where I went to school, in Seattle, where I grew up, Chicago, DC, San Diego, et cetera, all of these places that might have these very strong blue resources, but the folks there might feel that they want to do more to impact the national scene, do something else to move the national needle. And we have been developing an infrastructure for these folks to connect to those opportunities.
You know, there's another thing. The importance of state legislative races is huge. There is also the interstate, what is it called? The National Popular Vote, the Interstate Popular Vote Compact, something like that. It is this proposal that's been around for a while. The idea is to get states equaling 271 electoral college votes to commit to allocating those votes to the winner of the popular vote. And what this does is it means that it's a way of bringing democracy to the small d democracy to the presidential election process without a constitutional amendment, without formally abolishing the electoral college. It would basically mean that in effect whoever wins the popular vote would win the election. And I think this is an important thing for progressives to keep in mind, because we have had, you know, the last Republican president to win a majority was George H.W. Bush in terms of becoming president. George W. Bush won in 2004, but he was a minority president in 2000 again. So, okay, tell me exactly what your organization does on a kind of granular level.
Yes. So what we do at Sister District Project and how it works is that we've got over 27,000 folks on our list all across the country, and we are organized into over 65 active teams all across the country as well. And we take these volunteer teams and assign them, or sister them up, borrowing from a sister cities concept, assign them 2 to 3 state legislative candidates per cycle for support. Then these teams provide grassroots field and fundraising supports to these candidates throughout the cycle. For example, they will throw house party fundraisers, sometimes raising as little as $500, sometimes as much as $20,000. And all of that money goes directly to the candidates all of the fundraising we do for our organization is completely separate. So that grassroots fundraising, every dollar goes to the candidates. And so far, our average donation is about $34. So this is real small dollar support that's going to our candidates. I just heard, I saw a little testimonial video from one of our candidates in Michigan, Winnie Brinks. And she said that because of the tremendous support that Sister District, her teams, especially out in the Silicon Valley area and the Bay Area here, have provided, she's even with her opponent. But whereas his donations come from only 140 individual donors, her donors number in over 1,000. So this is the kind of real grassroots support when it comes to fundraising that Sister District helps to catalyze. We also provide field support. So our volunteer teams will organize phone bank parties, which you can phone bank from anywhere, as well as we're developing text banking opportunities, handwritten postcards. To all you postcard enthusiasts out there, we've got lots of great opportunities to do that. And, you know, some of these forms of voter contact are tried and true. Some of them are a little newer. I'm happy to talk a little bit later about what work we're doing out of Sister District Action Network, RC4, to do some research into these new forms of voter engagement. But what we do to make sure we're being helpful, because that's our top priority, is when we show up and we ask a campaign to work with us, we ask them, our first and last question is, how can we be helpful? And so in order to make sure we're helpful, we coordinate closely. So the lists that we get are all from the campaign. Sometimes we've got campaign veterans on staff who will help to, you know, help to cut the lists and help to develop the scripts and all of that stuff. But we do all of our work in close coordination with our campaigns.
Okay. So do tell me about the research that you were just referencing.
Yes, absolutely. So we've got, Sister District Project is a PAC 527. We don't think there's time for, how do I put this? It's time to get partisan. It's time to not be scared of power. And we need to go out there and seize it, and we need to do it electorally. So that's why Sister District Project is a expressly partisan organization. We do have an associated 501c4 called Sister District Action Network, out of which we are doing a number of things. One of them is these experiments to better understand the effectiveness of newer forms of voter contact, voter engagement. For example, handwritten postcards are extremely popular right now as a way to get involved. And we think of them a little bit like a kind of gateway drug when it comes to getting involved and volunteering. As you can imagine, the kind of reasons for that are pretty obvious. You kind of, if you're shy about being on the phone or being on the doors, you can start out by getting together with your community, meet some new folks, write some postcards to voters, and have that have those get sent in accordance to the campaign's strategy, which can be really great. And we try to push people to other forms, as they are ready. But the kinds of research we're doing, for example, we have a partnership with Voter Participation Center, which, as some of you may know, does really great voter registration work, especially focused on the rising American electorate. So that's young people, women, people of color. And one of the things that they do, a big part of the program, is a mail program. So they'll send out these voter registration forms. So with VPC, a couple months back, we sent almost 60,000 handwritten postcards to potential voters in Arizona, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Half of the folks were sent postcards as primers before they received their VPC mailer, and half of the folks received handwritten postcards as chasers, both encouraging them to make sure to pay attention, look out for their VPC form, and send it in. So we're still crunching the numbers there, but we have seen at least a small boost when it comes to the voter registration numbers for people who received a handwritten postcard. But you know, as far as we understand, a lot of this stuff doesn't have good or recent research on it. And our political director, as well as the director of research for Sister District Action Network, her name is Gabby Goldstein, and she is a brilliant strategic thinker and trained as a mixed method social scientist, just got her PhD from Berkeley, and is very interested in doing this kind of research to make sure that we are pushing our understanding of this forward as quickly as possible. And a lot of this we do for not only because we're trying to be very effective, but also so that we can explain to our volunteers how important this all is. We're very proud to have built a community of volunteers that is characterized by being extremely strategic and pragmatic. People want to do the highest impact and most important thing. So folks are really excited about the fact that we're doing this research as well alongside our expressly electoral work.
And are you working with Indivisible groups, other groups?
Absolutely, yes. Partnership is a cornerstone of our organization, and we cannot survive or succeed or win the kind of elections or progressive long-term power that we need without partnerships. So Indivisible, of course, is incredible. We consider ourselves and are proud to be sort of part of the same class of organizations that emerged from the, after the 2016 elections. Indivisible focuses a lot on advocacy, especially at the congressional level. And there are a lot of Indivisible groups out there who have little election committees where they've taken on sister district action items. And we think that's wonderful. We encourage very actively that kind of collaboration on the ground as much as we can. And we see that happening all across the country with all of our volunteers.
Again, this is something that's hopeful. This is part of a movement that is, you know, gives me some hope for the future. And I can't emphasize enough how much difference you can make in a state legislative race where, you know, there isn't millions of dollars sloshing around. I mean, there are in some races, I'm sure. But for the most part, you know, $10,000 makes a huge difference for these candidates who are running for a state legislature, especially in less expensive media markets. It's just huge. And if you're wondering if you make any difference if you phone bank from your blue enclave to wherever, there is very good research showing that just getting people to say that they're going to vote increases their likelihood of turning out and voting. So all of these small efforts that we see, I think we all hope, and there's reason to believe that there will be kind of an aggregate effect, and that's hopefully what we'll see continue. It's certainly what's happened so far in the special elections and street protests, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
Lala Wu, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It's great to chat with you.
Can you tell people before I let you go how they could get involved if they want to help?
Yes, absolutely. You can go to sisterdistrict.com and just click on volunteer. You can put in your email address and your zip code. You'll get added to our list. We send very, very few emails. I'm sure fewer than we're supposed to based on marketing conventional wisdom. And we will also connect you to your local team so you can get on the ground and connect with folks right away.
Folks, if you're thinking about how to get involved in legislative races that aren't your own, check it out. Okay, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break.
There are places I remember all my life. Though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone, and some remain. Recall, some are dead and some are living.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm always happy to welcome Carolee Coons to the show. Carolee is the managing editor of Crooks and Liars. Carolee, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me, and thanks for doing so on short notice. So I have tried to avoid this QAnon conspiracy theory because, frankly, it's too stupid. But now that all the media are running with it and talking to these people, and I guess it's getting a lot of attention, I figure, well, let's at least talk about it. For those who are fortunate to not know what this is, the QAnon conspiracy theory is actually not even a conspiracy theory. It's like, it's a wide-ranging conglomeration of old conspiracy theories. And but the basic outline of it is that all of our previous presidents have been like criminals, like part of the New World Order, or the maybe shape-shifting lizards, I don't know. And Donald, then the military got in touch with Donald Trump and said, well, we don't want to do a military coup. These are the military that aren't working for the globalists or the Illuminati or whatever. Yeah. They said, well, we were going to do a coup d'etat, but it would be better if you would just run for president and then clean everything up. And they have decided, it's like Pizzagate is a big part of this. So all of the, you know, bad people are pedophiles, of course. And Donald Trump is working secretly with Robert Mueller. So those of us as normies think that Robert Mueller is going after Trump, but actually they're in cahoots. And any day now we're going to have a reckoning, and all of the bad people, read Democrats and I guess, well, Democrats, are going to be rounded up and thrown into Guantanamo Bay. And this is supposedly, there's this person or people on these forums like 4chan and 8chan, because 8chan is that thing when 4chan isn't crazy enough for you, you go to 8chan.
Right.
And they believe that that there's this high level spook with a so-called Q clearance, which is actually a Department of Energy clearance, but let's just set that aside. And this person is dropping breadcrumbs, and they're following the breadcrumbs. So some person is on the internet riling up millions of Trump supporters with this crazy thing. The latest twist is that Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy Jr., JFK Jr., faked his own death in order to start all of this, and he is actually Q, the high-level spook. Anyway, so, Carolee, listen, do you ever get the thing where you're like, okay, they can't get any crazier than this?
And then they do.
Then they do, right? Uh-huh. I mean, like, I kind of thought Pizzagate was like, okay, well, that's about as nutty as they can get. Let me ask you this. There was this interesting piece a while ago, and I interviewed Chris Mooney on this show. Mooney wrote that book, The Republican Brain, about these cognitive differences between conservatives and liberals. And he had a bunch of research in that book, a couple of different studies that suggest that conservatives are more sensitive to cognitive dissonance and will go out of their way to avoid cognitive dissonance because they're vulnerable to it. It causes them pain in a way that liberals don't tend to do, right? We can kind of, it doesn't freak us out to experience cognitive dissonance, even though we don't like it. It is what it is.
Right.
And I wonder, is that what this is all about? Is it that the conservative media bubble isn't enough to provide an alternate explanation for the horrific series of news stories that you and I and normal people see every day?
You know, that's just as possible as anything else. I mean, I just don't, I don't know what to think anymore.
Folks, you heard me here first. Carolee Coons throwing up her hands in the air. I don't know what to do with these people.
I seriously don't. To me, they are like really like racist old men who are, you know, like looking for ways not to be. So they concoct all these stories about how, you know, like when they talk about throwing Democrats in Guantanamo, that's women and black people and Mexicans and stuff. That's not like white people like them.
Well, it's Hillary Clinton is a white person. Of course, she would be first to go in there. Mm-hmm. You know, it just seems to me that, you know, if you see Donald Trump as your great, the great white savior, and then he comes into office and just on a daily basis shows definitively that he is in it, way over his head, doesn't know what he's doing, and hasn't accomplished anything legislatively except that big tax cut. It just seems like this whole wild fantasy is like a way of justifying, you know, your continued support for this crackpot. So, I mean, it's just stunning to me that they're like, yeah, it must be the sleaziest real estate developer in New York City history, and this a total narcissist who's going to clean up, you know, who's in a secret plot to clean up. I mean, it was ridiculous enough to think the swamp.
Right.
I just don't. I'm also throwing my hands up in the air.
Yeah, well, I mean, your thinking is probably as good as any, is that they just need these theories to keep their faith, you know, that he is really going to do the things that he promised he'd do, even though it's clear he isn't going to do those things.
Right.
And so they cling to their faith by basically accepting all these bizarro conspiracy theories. But in the end, I mean, how is this any different than what, like, the John Birch people did, or even the Tea Party people? I mean, it seems like they're all of a piece of the same group of people.
They're the same people, but the medium has changed, right? I mean, the internet changes it because there's such a low barrier of entry. So there's now, like, kind of this question of, like, who started this thing? BuzzFeed had a piece, and I think the headline overstated it. It said the headline was, it's looking extremely likely that QAnon is a leftist prank on Trump supporters. This is by Ryan Broderick at BuzzFeed.
Oh, brother.
And yeah, it was out a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, most of these kinds of conspiracy theories are generated from people who want to believe them themselves, you know, and and again, I think the headline is overstated, but there is some evidence to suggest that it's possible that this is all some lefty, like, internet, you know, hacker
prank
kind of person. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just riling them up. And the thing that is striking is that, you know, we've had a guy go into a pizza place with a gun. Thank God nobody was hurt. We had another guy stop a dump truck on that bridge in Nevada, you know, where the, you know, that big dam, the Hoover Dam. He stopped his truck on the Hoover Dam, had a bunch of guns with him. And, you know, it seems really irresponsible, given how nutty these people are and how angry they are, to rile them up further, just in the sense that at some point there is going to be, you know, a reckoning. They are going to have a reckoning when Donald Trump is either, you know, impeached or not reelected, or maybe even reelected. But when, you know, there isn't a bunch of bad Democrats swept up and sent to Guantanamo for pedophilia.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
At some point they have to have like a, it just seems extremely dangerous. I don't know how these people are going to lash out when it doesn't turn out to be true.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of danger. This is only one of them, you know, that what they're doing with the press right now, or what Trump's doing with the press right now, is just as bad, but if not worse, in terms of, there's a lot. I mean, giving wackos a reason to be violent, there's a zillion different ways that can happen. It's just that this whole QAnon thing is so utterly out in Mars somewhere. It's like everything. And so steeped in baloney, you know, like Q is the 17th letter of the alphabet. And, you know, so that has some magic.
They've done lots of weird things like that. There's all these kind of secret language and codes. And they're gleaning little things, but it just shows in the depths of the epistemological divide right now. Like, if you ask anybody who's not in that hermetically sealed bubble, it just sounds moronic on its face. Like, I was, you know, when I was prepping for this segment, I thought, how do these people get through their days? Like, if you're stupid enough to believe this, how is it that you're able to, like, tie your own shoes? It's so striking to me that the you know, intellectual depths that we're dealing with. And the other thing that I thought about is there was a piece, I don't remember who wrote it, not long ago, and it was arguing that Trump supporters belong to a cult.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of pushback on it from experts in cults, and they said, no, they're certainly very partisan, they're tribal, you know, they have a, you know, closed information system, but they don't have all these other features of a cult.
Yeah.
And I wonder if they're revising their view in light of this QAnon thing, because it is really, really cultish.
Oh, it is cultish. And I'd have to, that my first reaction to it was that this just proves that the cultic level of, you know, his core base supporters, right, is that there's any of them that actually would stand outside a rally with, you know, QAnon proudly on their
Might as well
t-shirts.
Just wear a sign that says, I am a moron. I'm the dumbest person here.
Right. I have no capacity for critical thought because I'm just a brainwashed cult follower. Yeah, I mean, that's...
And then they call other people sheeple.
All right, I know. Well,
to top it all off, and because 2018... The Hill reported that Anonymous, the hacking collective Anonymous, is now going after QAnon, and so is Jack I don't know how to pronounce that guy.
Prosobiec, yeah.
Uh-huh. Prosobiec. Good job, Carolee. I would not even... I've got him blocked on Twitter, so I don't have to be exposed to too much of his nonsense, but say it again?
Prosobiec. Yeah.
He's also apparently trying to debunk QAnon. I wonder what his angle is.
Yeah, that's a good question, because he's the Pizzagate guy.
I mean, he's full of nonsense. Yeah, he's the Pizzagate guy.
Yeah, so I don't know why, and I'm not sure that I believe that he's trying to debunk much. I think that he's angling for more followers, maybe, but I don't think that he's trying to debunk anything. I just think
maybe
he wants to
jealous.
Be an influencer. Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's like whoever it is that isn't him who's getting all these people sucked into this, he wants to be on that train.
Yeah. And I think QAnon is bigger than Pizzagate.
Oh, it's way bigger.
Way bigger.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, we live in interesting times.
Yes. I guess you could say that. Yes.
Carolee Coons, I believe we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time, and I'm sorry to bother you with something so stupid.
Oh, well, next time we'll have to do something smarter.
Next time we're going to talk about something that is less idiotic. Carolee Coons, thank you so much. Read Carolee at Crooks and Liars. I'd also like to thank Denise Merrill and Lala Wu. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L, if you would like. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud or wherever else you find your podcasts. You can write an angry email to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I will check that at some point. And I would also like to thank the good folks at Hullabaloo, Digby, Crooks and Liars, that's Carolee Coons again, and the Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.